I'm a little confused by, I confuse myself by that title, but the Higley Bunton Group is going to be a pretty tough group to follow. You know, listening to Leon and to Dave and to Yu Chang, I just was having flashbacks of some of the things that had happened at K-State with Randy and his project. But, you know, Tim Gibb was his first PhD student, and Tim did work on corn. And he worked on velvet leaf, sphere of influence, velvet leaf in corn, and he had big plots up at Scandia, which is a couple hours from campus. And so we would leave to work up there. Of course, we had to go on Saturdays because that's the only day you could get a whole crew of people together that didn't have classes interfering. So Saturdays was our day. 6 o'clock we would leave, and we would always go to Burger King for breakfast. And then we would go out to the field. And so I'm a new graduate student, and I was hauled off too. And so we started on, we had our breakfast, and then we went out to the field, and we he had invented, of course, you know, with Randy, he's very creative, and he invented this way of rolling up. You may have remembered in the lab these just mountains of these rolled up soybean, this in this particular case it was corn, and velvet leaf. So you could unroll and kind of recreate the sphere of influence. And so I remember we started working, and we're working along. Anybody hungry? No, we're okay. So we keep working, and then yeah, we're getting hungry. Well, we got to finish this rep. Have you ever heard that, Leon? We have to finish the rep. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we finally finished the rep. We're all famished completely. Last thing we had to eat was at Burger King for breakfast at about 7 o'clock, and so we head down the road to go to lunch. Got to come back and finish the last rep, but we head down the road, and when we came upon a they were having a contest, a corn husking contest, I believe, and they had a little wagon out there in the field that was cooking up pork burgers. And so we were starving. Let's check it out. So we go over, and we all of us wolf down. You know, this is late, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He's closing up. We buy all of his pork burgers, put all the condiments on them that we can, wolf them down, and go back. Then we have to go back to work. That was one of the things that flashed through my mind, because after that, whenever we get a new student working in our lab, my advice to them, because as you remember, and Mary, I'm sure, will verify this, Randy didn't drink coffee, right? Right. So my advice to students when they came to work for us is, when you're working with Randy, every chance you get, eat, go to the bathroom, because you never know when your next opportunity is going to come along. Well, right? So, yeah. So that's, so I've put together a few slides. You know, Randy was just tireless. He was tireless and always aiming the program for the extraordinary. And Leon, you reminded me of this when, and I think we did this to keep up with you. We had the two projector programs. Do you remember those? We had two slide projectors in those days, two slide projectors going. And so we had double slides and this projector and that projector, and you had to push the right button. And we did that because Leon had sort of set some kind of a standard that now we had to do that also. And I flashed onto that. We had to be, and of course we were. We wanted to be extraordinary working for him. And I have kind of a motto of something that I thought of when I think of Randy and his, you know, the way he did his work. Anything that can be done well, and we all did our things well, can be done better. So we really try to do the job well, and then we try to exceed ourselves and do even more well. And sometimes, if times allows, I still try to do that, you know. And Randy had a very strong commitment to the land grant mission and the integration of research, extension, and teaching. He didn't have a teaching assignment, but when I was there, he started, and I don't know if it was the same module course that you were talking about, Mary, but he started teaching an experiential course for graduate students to get some extension. And is that course still taught? Still taught. I think Marlon and I and Tim and I don't know who else were the guinea pigs on that, but we got credit for actually developing the course, and then we got to take the course too. But so he didn't have a teaching appointment at all, but his commitment was just huge. And of course, the research and extension, and you know, that's that, you know, he just had such a strong commitment. You know, you know, when we do a project, it was always done with excellence. In getting it right was kind of one of his things. And I remember when they started talking about this, you know, out-of-the-box thinking, you know. And you know, Randy was doing that a long time before that phrase became popular, wasn't he, Leon? I mean, he was very creative in his thinking. And so he kind of invented that phrase. That phrase was invented for him because that's the kind of really creative thinker he was. He leaves a huge legacy. He leaves a legacy of his family. He leaves a huge legacy in the entomological community and in all of us, students that he trained, peers and collaborators in entomology. It's huge. And, you know, listening to Dave and to Leon, the one thing that I forgot to add to this is his great enthusiasm. I remember in Yu Cheng, I don't know if he's still here, when I found the first blister beetle swarm. You know, this is what I was doing my master's on at that time, and you know, we hadn't seen one, so we presumed they existed, but we didn't know if we're going to find them in Kansas. So I was out working, trying to find them, and when I found my first one, I was so excited. I came back to campus and, you know, went to Randy and said, "I found a swarm," and he was like, "Oh, we got to go see it." So back we troop out to the field to see the swarm. And, you know, his enthusiasm was absolutely contagious of thinking, okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to approach this? This is a great problem. And what, you know, where are we going to go from here? Brainstorming was Randy was just trying to keep up with him. You know, he just was so creative, and he would just spin off so many ideas that you know, it was just, you had to take your notebook out to kind of keep up with him. What I thought I'd talk today about a little bit is to illustrate kind of the kind of training and the kind of thinking in a project that he was not necessarily closely involved in, but at the end you'll sort of see where he comes back into this. And I think he would really like this project a lot, because the germ of this project came from a producer, and we are able to deliver back to a producer. And Randy came from a farm. He trained a lot of us not farm kids. And he was always quizzing us and really wanted us to have that same appreciation. And he really related to producers and to delivering something of value back to them. This project integrates the what Leon and Dave both talked about, that integration of agronomy and entomology, because his dual major, and he'd always be talking about the plant. We got to remember the plant. And in this particular case, we developed a local solution, but it's a solution that then, after talking with him, we kind of looked at how it might apply or to other parts of the country, and I'll talk about that. And then we were able to kind of come up with some underlying rationale of why it worked locally, but why it doesn't work in other places. And I think he would have really appreciated that too, of learning more than just solving the problem, but getting a little bit more depth in understanding that problem. So the cast of characters, you all know, the plant, the alfalfa weevil, and, you know, we're going to talk a little bit, focus a little bit on management, and particularly cultural controls. And cultural controls can be kind of tricky because, you know, you have to kind of make them work. It's not like, you know, an insecticide where you go out there and it works. You know, you have to kind of fiddle with these kind of projects in order to make them work. And we worked in Montana with early cutting. Now, early cutting is a funny thing with alfalfa. It's not very widely used. And we'll talk a little bit about that. But it reportedly causes some weevil larvae mortality. So, you know, there's something there, but why isn't it used more widely or more widely recommended? One of the reasons for that is it compromises yield and quality. If you cut early, you compromise yield. and perhaps quality. So those are some of the factors here. And but in Montana, and I would give, you know, I was, when I started off there, I was 80% extension, 20 research. And so I did my extension thing. And in one of the audiences, you know, when I talked about this early cutting, some Montana producers would, you know, kind of visit with me and say that I use that early cutting, it works really well with me. And one grower at one meeting raised his hand and said, well, I always rake my hay and I've never had any problems with that early cutting. Sometimes you can get a little bit of delay in green up with early cutting because you don't kill the larvae. You put them, concentrate them in the windrow, and if you are delayed in getting the hay baled, you could end up with kind of a mess. And so we did the study to kind of look at that because, you know, when I answered this question, I kind of got to thinking about it on the drive home. Huh, that raking, huh? That's really interesting because I had done some recommending with some producers on stubble treatments because the weevil populations were so high that they would go back in, they'd put the irrigation back on, and nothing would happen. The plants would not grow because the weevils were still feeding out there. So, you know, that was kind of interested me. And so we did this study. We had five location years. These were all production alfalfa fields. Now, I noticed when Yu Chang was talking about the blister beetle work, that blister beetle project had kind of ramped up since I was at K-State. And they had their tractor, and Yu Chang was driving a tractor. Randy never let me drive a tractor. We didn't even have a tractor. He probably borrowed that from somebody, I guess. But he was very good at acquiring the tools that he needed in order to get the job done. And, you know, one of the things when we started this project is, we want to look at weevil populations all through the year. We want to look at them all through the cutting sequence. We want to look at standing hay, but then we're going to cut it, and then we're going to rake it, and then we're going to bale it, and we need to trace the population all the way through. So we decided we had to look at number per square feet, which is a little bit more tedious way to do this, but you know, to get that consistency. And then we compared early cutting with this other technique of early cutting and then adding that raking step. And so we had, like I say, 5-year locations. We're working with producers, so things don't always happen on the schedule that you would really, really like. But with Randy's program, you learn to, kind of compensate for that. And so we rake most of our fields between about, 58-60% and 75% dry matter. And what was kind of interesting is we looked at yields, no difference in between these two kind of techniques. We looked at all kinds of quality factors. We look at crude protein, ADFs, NDFs, no difference. We did pre-harvest counts. In fact, there was no difference, but you notice that they were a little higher in one set of plots just by happenstance. But what was really interesting is in that when we raked, we got a lower number of larvae left in the ground after we had baled up and picked up the hay, to the point where our stubble treatment recommendations at that time were 8 larvae per square feet. So we're pretty close to that with our early cutting treatment, but that when we added the raking treatment, we were able to cut that in about half. And so that was pretty neat. So it worked pretty well for us there. This just summarizes that stuff. We didn't see any difference in quality. Of course, the rake forage sped up drying a little bit too. In our case, the forage was ready to bale a day earlier in I think 3 out of 5 of those sites. And then we saw the reduction in the number of larvae left in the hay stubble after baling. So we're kind of looking at, well, where do these larvae end up? What happens to them? And so we looked at number of larvae and where they end up as a percentage of total alive larvae. So we're only looking at live larvae. And that first graph there shows you the the windrow, what stays in the windrow. The second one there shows you what happens in between the windrow. And then the third one shows you what's going on underneath the windrow. And this is the x-axis is all windrow dry matter. And so what we were seeing in Montana is that as the hay was drying down, the weevils were staying in it to a point. And at some point, they started to migrate out of it. And mostly, they migrated into the in between the wren rows, probably where the hay was still growing, would be my guess. And so these are kind of normal curves. Now, if you did an early cutting or early raking where you raked and you sped up the drying, that might cause those curves to look a little bit different. But we kind of figure out where the larvae were and where we need to be looking and where the where they were relative to that raking stage. And so what we found in Montana is that early cutting worked pretty well, and raking really improved our weevil management. And we also found where we do make stubble treatment sometimes, we were able to reduce that number because of the impact on the larvae populations. Raking, of course, also does reduce drying time, and that's why a lot of people do that. And then that last step about where the larvae migrate to. And I got to talking to Randy about this because, you know, I'm talking about in Montana how this technique works. And we were talking about why it doesn't work in Kansas and other places. And so talking to him, I kind of got the idea of putting this together where we looked at sort of what's going on in the system. And Randy was real big at looking at the bigger picture of looking at the system. And so the green line there just kind of shows the larvae populations, where they peak. And it's very idealized here. But, you know, our experience over many, and Matt can attest to this, many years of doing this kind of work, that's what our weevil population does in Montana. We're seeing peak larvae populations in June. And the arrow there indicates when farmers are starting to harvest. So you can see they're starting to harvest very close to that peak of where the weevil populations are very high. And if we move that cutting date up about a week, we can get early cutting and we can get some benefit on controlling weevils. And so Randy and I got to talking at one meeting, why doesn't this work in Kansas? And so we talked about it and we came up with some of these dates and I kind of looked at them. And in Colorado, where I worked before I went to Montana, the weevil populations are peaking earlier, quite a bit earlier in Colorado and in Kansas. The cutting dates are also moving up, but not as much. They're not moving up quite as much as the weevil. And so where in Montana, the weevil populations and the harvest timing is quite synchronous, in Colorado and Kansas, it gets less synchronous, more asynchronous. And if you move down to New Mexico, where I also worked on alfalfa, the weevil populations are peaking much, much, much earlier. And even though the cutting date is earlier, it's not, it's still, there's an asynchrony there. And so Randy and I talked about this, about why it's not a recommended practice in certain states, but why it works quite well in a state like Montana. And I think one of the tricks to this is that the weevil, the overwintering weevil population isn't in diapause. It's waiting for winter to be over, but it estivates in the summer, not the winter. And in New Mexico, they're out there laying eggs all winter long, whereas in Montana, different strain, or they're smarter, or something. But you don't see any adults until May, really, in Montana. They're just that much later, and so it's a really interesting. To me, it's a very interesting process when you look at it more broadly of why this cultural control works in one area of the country and doesn't work very well in another part of the country. Very suitable to Montana conditions because of the synchrony of the weevil and the plant. And I think Randy would have really liked that, looking at that, both of those things together. In Montana, that early cutting doesn't really harvest yield or quality very much because you're just moving up the harvest date about 7 days, and it doesn't really impact quality or yield that much. It's a great non-chemical method for weevil control. And so I think something that, you know, some of the many things that Randy taught me, and I think one thing he would have really appreciated about this type of work was relating the crop phenology, the alfalfa weevil life cycle, and the management all together into a package, and explaining why that technique is effective in one area of the country but not another. And I could just hear him, now that I'm in South Dakota, saying, you've got a nice opportunity. That is a word I learned from Randy Higgins, opportunity. Every time I say that now that I'm a department head, I say that to a faculty member. You know, this would be a really good opportunity. I just have to smile inside because Randy didn't look at it as a, you know, you should do this. This is a great opportunity for you. And so that word just is, you know, that word, just I just think of Randy whenever I say that or try to put that idea of an opportunity into somebody else's head. So that, I could just hear him now saying, great opportunity, you're in South Dakota, in between Montana and Kansas and Colorado. That would be a good place to test this. And if I free up some time sometime, Tom, I might actually do that. The other thing about this project that I think that Randy would have really appreciated is that it was really grower connected. It was connected at the beginning, and when I went back to the same site about 5 years later, I said, somebody in this room asked me this question 5 years ago, and now I've got an answer for you, and I'm going to tell you about it today. And that was, to me, kind of neat, is bringing that full circle and bringing it back to the farmer and the farming community that could actually use that. And Randy, I think, always really used that research and extension together so well. Mark Johnson was telling me about how he was kind of the new model for an extension, you know, an extension faculty member, in that he really brought those two things together really well. And so I've, you know, I've tried to kind of stay with that same thing. Some of the, you know, challenges that Randy provided, he provided them in terms of opportunities. And, you know, that sort of out-of-the-box thinking of how can we look at this in a different way or in a bigger picture and kind of get at what is going on. He and his program over the years, many graduate students, postdocs, and students that he trained, undergraduate students as well, provided many, many benefits to the state of Kansas and the Kansas producers, and in the North Central region as well, and nationally. I talked to people that, you know him from I don't know where. He was on a committee with them. And, you know, everybody remembers him very vividly because of that critical and really creative thinking. And that's just something that is, you know, hard to train people to do. He really had that, and he really inspired a lot of people. And coming back to that, you know, anything that can be done well, you can do better. You know, it was always kind of that trying to push you. And I remember meeting you two guys for the first time at a North Central etymology meeting at Iowa State. I think it was an Iowa State mixer. I'm not sure, but I think that's what it was. And he was taking me and Tim around and introducing us to Iowa State, because it's the first, you know, we didn't know you guys. And so I remember, you know, we're meeting and everyone in it's very formal. And then Randy kind of wandered off. And so you said, okay, come on, tell us what he's really like to work for. Come on, you know, have you got your hole punch yet? And, you know, and we're like, what? Well, the thing is, he did challenge you, and we did work hard. But we worked as a team, and that made it that much better. And he never asked you to do anything that he wasn't doing himself. He would come out to the field and work right along with you, eating lunch at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And so, you know, you just really didn't feel like you were being, it was anything extraordinary. You were just part of the team. But I do remember us going out to spray plots. And we, I don't know, I guess none of the other students are here. Maybe you, Cheng, maybe you remember this. We would load up two pickup trucks, we would have them completely loaded. We brought out big 55-gallon drums of water, sprayers, spray equipment, chemical, blah, blah, blah. The whole truck would just be completely full. And I remember one time, we're loading up the truck. We have a whole stream of people going back and forth with stuff. And so I stopped by the sink and I was going, and Randy goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "We need the kitchen sink, don't you think?" And he just, "Get out there, get to work." And then we went out to the field and the wind was blowing too much. Drove all the stuff back and had to unpack the whole truck and do it again tomorrow, 6 a.m. That was our magic number. But it was, I just remember so many great experiences. It was great hearing the Iowa State story a little bit better because it put some of those things, we had our hole punches. And I remember him making, quite a big deal out of that. And the corn project. And then we did that sphere of influence thing with Velvet Leaf with soybeans. And then we had more rolls of soybeans and Velvet Leaf all rolled up. And we had a mountain. I guess whenever we did a project, we had a mountain of samples that the grad students and the undergraduate just tackle one at a time and start laying them out in the lab. So, a lot, but I just remember so many, neat things and neat things about the training I received. And I guess we try to pass that on, as Leon said so well. So, thanks very much, and appreciate being here.